Morning. I realized when I was going through my saved files that I had preached the very first sermon of the year, and now I'm preaching the very last sermon of the year. So if I had thought more about it, I might have bookended everything, but I didn't, so we'll just go with what I have. Since we're having a party tonight to celebrate the coming of the new year, I thought that we would, you know, cover a story about Jesus and a party. So if you turn with me in your Bibles to John chapter 2, we're going to look at a party that he attended, a wedding party. Not a board game party, I'm sorry. Couldn't find that one in there. The thing about this is one that is familiar, one that is familiar by pretty much everybody. There's very few people in the United States who hasn't heard of Jesus turning water into wine. But as I dug deeper into the story, preparing for this, I came across some great ideas about this text, all from other people who are way smarter than I am. So most of this morning's message is going to be coming from them, a lot of it from Tim Keller, if you're not familiar with him. So if you, if I lose you at some point, you can just read his stuff and you'll find most of it there. But let's go ahead and read the text, starting at verse 1, John chapter 2. It says, "The next day there was a wedding celebration in the village of Canaan in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, 'They have no more wine.' 'Dear woman, that's not our problem,' Jesus replied. 'My time has not yet come.' But his mother told the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.' Standing nearby were six stone water jars used for the Jewish ceremonial washing. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus told the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' When the jars had been filled, he said, 'Now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies.' So the servants followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. 'A host always serves the best wine first,' he said. 'Then when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now.' This miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him." A quick caveat to what we're going to be talking about this morning. We're talking about wine. We're talking about alcohol. And I know a lot of people in our culture have struggles with that. This is different, all right? The wine in the ancient times is different than our modern wines today, okay? This isn't a drink till you get drunk kind of wine. Alcoholic wine, back then, it was much lower alcohol content, was consumed after significantly diluting it with water. And this is attested to by other cultures surrounding Israel. This isn't just Israel. This is everyone during that time. It was really rendered by diluting it. It was rendering its alcohol content to negligible by our standards. Okay, it's kind of akin to us adding those little powder packets to water, all right, to change the taste. So this is not crazy, all right. We're not talking about getting drunk tonight by any means. Okay. But I just want to take that off the table, all right? We need to take off our modern thinking cap here and put on an ancient culture thinking cap if we're going to approach this text, because it was different. They didn't party the same way that we party today, or some people party, okay? All right, with that said, why is this story even in the Bible? All right, if you were telling the story of the most influential person to have ever walked the earth, why begin telling about his ministry with this story? It's not just a miracle, right? Verse 11 calls it a miraculous sign. It's a picture, and it was chosen by Jesus to be the first son. It's almost a parable being acted out as a picture of all that he is and all that Christianity is. Reynolds Price, in his introduction to the book of John, says, "If you were inventing a biography of Jesus Christ, you would never invent for your inaugural sign a miraculous solution to a mere social embarrassment. The only logical explanation for this particular sign being the first one is that it must have happened." He says, "I, as a writer, I know this. If I was inventing a life of Jesus, I would want to make sure the first miracle was extremely quintessential." So any leader of a great new movement, when they make their first public presentation, they take tremendous care to give a balanced picture of what the movement is all about. So therefore, since Jesus was the greatest movement leader in the history of the world, obviously the very first sign, the very first thing he did, not walking on water, all right, not raising someone from the dead, not all the other possibilities that could be better or far more dramatic. Instead, what you have here is something that seems like not a very big deal. All right, a party looks like it's going to go 2 days instead of 3 days. Okay, wow, what a shame, right? If you're going to develop your own gospel, fabricate your own first miracle of Jesus, you would never in a million years do this. But Jesus did. Why? Why did Jesus do this miracle? Why did he do it this way? Why was this the first one? And like verse 11, how does this reveal his glory? If you ask that question, why does this reveal his glory? There's so much more in this story. You come so much closer to knowing who he came to be, what he came to do, what he has to offer, and how we can receive it. It's all here in this one story. All right. Let's look at verse 8 and 9, find out who he was. There's a term here that you don't find anywhere else in the New Testament. All right. He said, "Now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies." The master of ceremonies, you don't find that anywhere else. What is the master of ceremonies? We think of a lot like what we have a master of ceremonies today. It might be your version might say master of the banquet, kind of like a hype man. It was the person to preside over the festivities, right? The person they hired to be the life of the party. It was the person who said, "Let's do this, now let's do this." He kept everything going. And they would get things stirred up and make it a great party. This party is about to fall flat. And Jesus saves this guy's hide, right? Because he provides what is necessary for the party. So he reveals himself to be the true master of the banquet, the real Lord of the feast. Let's ask the question, why would Jesus in his first miracle, his first public showing, why would he do this to show the world who he was? What does it mean for him to be the Lord of the feast? To create about 150 gallons or so of the most delicious, hideous wine in order to make a dying party into an incredible party, lifting it to new heights. Why was this his first miracle? Because what he is saying is, I came to be the master of the banquet. I came to be the Lord of the feast. Yes, he comes to suffer, to be humbled. And if you follow him, yeah, we will too. But there's plenty of self-denial, suffering, and humbling, but these are just a means to an end. Here's the end. As master of the banquet, as Lord of the feast, he has come. Jesus says in this miracle, which is a parable of what's to come, you know all these old stories. They were familiar with all the old stories, all the old mythologies, of stuff like Dionysus, tales that find the old ancient traditions of days when the forest would run with wine and there'd be feasting and dancing and reveries. All that is kid stuff to what Jesus came to do. He says, haven't you read the prophets, what they said about his day? Isaiah 25 says, in Jerusalem, the Lord of heaven's armies will spread a wonderful feast for all the people of the world. It will be a delicious banquet with clear, well-aged wine and choice meat. Then he will remove the cloud of gloom, the shadow of death that hangs over the earth. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away all tears. He will remove forever all insults and mockery against his land and people. The Lord has spoken. Jesus says, of all the things I could tell you, of all the things I could begin with, and there are many, many things, but this is the first. This is the primary. I have come to bring simple joy. Why is it this morning that most people are not worshiping anywhere? You know, there are a lot of reasons. There are. But one that I keep hearing, one that keeps coming up, people are saying, you know, I had an upbringing in the church. I had an upbringing in the Christian faith, but now I want to enjoy myself, right? I had that religious stuff, but I want to have fun. Is there even a part of you that understands Christianity this way? Christianity as the rules, suck it up, just say no. Keep your nose clean. Stay out of trouble. You know, I know it's a grind, but if you want to stay out of hell, this is just the way it is. Is that Christianity? Is that what you think Christianity is? Do you believe that that's all it is? Jesus challenges us to think differently. Jesus says, look, I almost don't care if you reject me, but you're not rejecting me intelligently. You don't even know what you are rejecting. Do you believe these things? Do you dare say to me, I reject Christianity because I want to have fun? You don't even know who I am. You don't even know what you have rejected. I am the Lord of the feast. I come to the world to make the world run with wine. You know, there are a lot of reasons to reject me, but this is not one of them. This is the first thing that we see in this passage. He shows us who he is, to be the Lord of the feast, to bring the party. Secondly, he shows us what he came to do. According to Tim Keller, the key to understanding this whole passage is verse 4. You read that verse and it seems kind of weird. But Mary comes to him, and it is a very reasonable request. When the wine goes out of the party, that is the end of the party. All right. And you know that it's a serious thing for the party. All right. It's an embarrassing social blunder. And in those days, weddings were big deals. All right. They lasted a longer time than ours do today. They were central to the village. They brought everybody together. And for the wine to give out was probably a bigger thing than it would be for us today. All right. So she comes and she says they have no wine. And it's not ridiculously unimportant. She knows his power because she has seen it. She knows who he is. She heard the angel, right? The angel told her who he was. She knows. And secondly, she knows his love and his concern. It is absolutely not wrong for her to come to him and say, they've run out of wine, can you do something about it? But what does he say? Woman? Right? As some of your texts might say, dear woman. All right, but dear isn't even in the original language. It just says woman. He's not there saying, and I don't know, maybe the translators are afraid of letting you see what he says here, but he's not saying, mom, right? He's not going, why are you forcing my, you know, he says, woman, why do you involve me? My time is not yet come. And it's brusque and it's harsh. And second, it doesn't seem to fit. Right? It seems out of place in this story. She says, can you do something about this problem? And he says, my time has not yet come. Weird response. All right, if I went to my kids and I asked them, hey, you mind doing the dishes? And they said, my time has not yet come. And that seemed kind of out of place. All right. He is obviously troubled, and he's clearly thinking about something else. What does this mean? He's thinking about something else. His mind is a million miles away. All right. When I've read this over the years, my first thought was that he was saying, you are forcing my hand, and I'm not ready to do it yet. All right. So many times I've read this text, and that's what I thought. But because he immediately turns around and does the miracle, it may not mean what we think it means. All right. We cannot treat this like we would others. We can't treat Jesus like we would think of other people. All right. It's not time for a miracle, and then a few minutes later, well, all right. All right, this is the greatest movement leader in the history of the world. These things are calculated. These things are thought through. So since we don't believe that he was just changing his mind, then why does he say, my time has not yet come? He's thinking about something, but what is it? All right, he's thinking about two things. If you're like me, you go to weddings, you sit there, and sometimes it brings about thoughts of your own wedding, right? If you aren't married yet, maybe you're thinking of your wedding to come. What will it be like? Who will be my spouse? Will I even get married? You know, myself now, when I'm at weddings, I think about my own, how fun it was, hanging out with family, friends, how beautiful my spouse is. It conjures up things that reminds me of what it was like. You know, sometimes you sit there and your thoughts are a million miles away. You're not thinking of this time, you're thinking of another time. And just like Jesus was here. But if Jesus is thinking about his wedding, the Bible tells us his consciousness, his understanding of his wedding day would have stirred him far more deeper than it stirs us. The Old Testament tells us that the prophets for hundreds of years had said God, the God of the Bible, does not simply want to relate to us like a king to subjects. He doesn't want to rule us. He doesn't just want to relate to us like a shepherd does to sheep. He doesn't simply relate to us even as a father to children. We're told again and again that God wants to relate to us as a husband to a wife. He wants to know us and love us and unite with us so profoundly like a husband to a wife. Therefore, throughout the Old Testament, God continues to characterize himself as our bridegroom, the bride of a people who gives themselves to the bridegroom of a people who gives themselves to him as a bride does to her husband. We know that Jesus had taken this into his own conscience. He was God. He knew this. This is how he wants to relate to us, the bridegroom, to be the bridegroom. And we know that because Jesus later on has the audacity in the book of Matthew when someone says, why don't your disciples fast like everybody else's? He says what? He says, do the friends of the bridegroom fast when the bridegroom is still with them? He is the bridegroom. If you go to the end of the chapter 3 of John, John the Baptist is asked by his followers, they come to him and they say, hey, everybody's leaving you. Everyone's leaving us and going over to this Jesus. But what does John say? Because he understood the claim. He understood who Jesus was. And he says, why shouldn't they? The bride is for the bridegroom. I'm just a friend of the bridegroom. Who is the bride? John, at the end of the book of Revelation, tells us that Jesus is thinking about at this wedding, what Jesus is thinking about at this wedding. John writes, "And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven like a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. Blessed are those who are invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb." Jesus is thinking of his wedding day, the day in which the people who say that all I am, all that I have, I give to you. And on that day, the wedding feast, it will be the wedding feast to end all wedding feasts. And that can't be all that he's thinking about here, right? Because when we think about our own future, it's scary because we don't know what's going to happen, right? We don't know what will happen, how it will happen, what it's going to be, but Jesus does. Jesus knows. So why is he acting so troubled? Why is he so abrupt? Why is he so clearly under a certain amount of stress here when his mother talks to him? He's not only thinking about the wedding feast, he's thinking about what it will take for him to provide the wine for his own wedding feast. That it is the only way to fully really explain this. When she comes to him and says there is no more wine, what he literally says here is, "My hour is not yet come. My hour is not yet come." In the book of John, Jesus' hour has a very technical meaning. In chapter 7, verse 30, chapter 8, verse 20, chapter 12, verse 23, chapter 13, verse 1, all use it the same way. The hour means the hour of his death. Mary says, "We need wine for the wedding feast," and he says, "It's not my time to die yet." And that seems like a weird response unless you realize that he's looking into the future as something for which the present is a parable, is a pattern. Of course, he isn't talking about this wine. He doesn't have to die to create the wine for the party. Of course, he's talking about his own wedding feast. But as soon as she comes to him and says there's no more wine, he says, "Oh my word. The only way I'm going to be able to produce wine for my wedding feast, the only way I'm going to be able to unite with my bride is I'm going to have to go through the hour of my death." And if you don't think that's what he means, he couldn't be any clearer in the way that he chose to create the wine. Verse 6 says, "Now there were 6 stone water pots standing there." But they weren't just any water pots, were they? They were used for the Jewish custom of purification. You can't get any clearer than that. But the custom of purification, it was when the Jews, it's what they had to do before they went into the temple. It was their custom to wash before they went into the presence of God. And it didn't really do anything. Washing wasn't salvation, but it was a sign to them that we are sinners, that we have moral impurities, and we need to be cleansed or we cannot be embraced by God. They were going into a clean space, and they had to be clean to do so. When Jesus was turning this water into wine, he was probably remembering years ago when in Egypt, God once turned water into blood as a curse. But now for Jesus to turn water into wine, it stands for his blood. At the Last Supper, he says, "This cup is my blood." When he sees wine, he thinks of his blood. In Egypt, it was a curse. They died from lack of things to drink. But today, he turns water into blood as a blessing because it is his blood for us. It is the thing that will truly cleanse us, and therefore, why is Jesus acting the way he is? He's thinking of this. Another minister put it this way: Jesus Christ is sitting in the midst of all this joy, sipping the cup of sorrow. And you know why? There is no way that Jesus can think about what it will take to give his bride the cup of joy and gladness without thinking about the cup he was going to have to drink. He even says in the garden, "Take this cup from me." If he's going to feast with us, if he is going to have us in his arms, if we are going to drink from the rivers of his grace, if we're going to come into the festival of joy of the marriage supper, our marriage supper with him, he is going to have to go through the hour. In order to drink the cup of joy with us, he is going to have to drink the cup of eternal justice. Now you see why John says in verse 11, his glory was revealed in this. We see who he is, the Lord of the feast, what he came to do, to give his blood for us as the true bridegroom. Thirdly, it shows what he can offer, what he came to offer. He came to offer a powerful sensation and a complete reception. Why does the Bible continually talk about salvation as wine? Why does it talk about Christianity as a feast? The Bible doesn't say that we will start the kingdom of heaven with a feast. It says that the kingdom of heaven is a feast. The Bible keeps pushing on us these sensory experience language when it comes to our relationship with God. Why? Why did he give us these senses? The Bible in Psalms says that it's not enough to know God is good. I want you to taste and see that God is good. Right? It's not enough to know the power and love and goodness and holiness of God, but you must taste it. You must see it. Jonathan Edwards says that we are not invited to anything less than this. You are invited to experience God. You are invited to, and you get, when you become a Christian, a new sensory ability. He says there's a difference between believing in God, that God is holy and gracious, and having a new sense of the heart of the loveliness and beauty of that holiness and grace. The difference between believing that God is gracious and tasting that God is gracious is the difference is as different as having a rational belief that honey is sweet and having actual experience of its sweetness. What is Christianity? You're not invited to sign a series of beliefs or obey a set of rules, but you are invited to a feast. The first step in tasting this new sense of the heart is that you begin to hunger for it. You begin to long for it. You hunger and thirst for God's righteousness. Second, you begin to delight in them. Right? The things aren't just there. They delight you. They become sweet to you. They excite you. And lastly, they begin to actually satisfy you. They begin to overwhelm you like wine. They go to your head. You begin to say that the love of God outshines what other people say about me. The wisdom of God outshines my own wisdom. Jesus offers you wine, a feast, a powerful sensation. This miracle also shows that he offers you complete reception. When Jesus says he is the king, or he calls himself a shepherd, that says something about us, right? We are the subjects, or we are the sheep in these illustrations. But when he says he's the bridegroom, when he says he is the bridegroom, he is saying that he's ravished with us. He can hardly stand still. He wants to run down the aisle and take us. He wants to give himself to us as we want to give ourselves to him. He is offering complete reception. When the groom stands at the front of the church and sees the bride for the first time, all adorned, beautiful dress, hair all done up, not a blemish anywhere. All right, if as a minister, for doing weddings, you stand there, you see brides come down the aisle. They're never, never ugly, right? They've gone all out. We do not see their blemishes anymore, right? Whatever they do, sometimes we might think, what does she see in him, right? But we never think, what does he see in her? When she comes down that aisle, she's always beautiful. And that's what Christ sees in us. Through his death and resurrection, that is how God sees us as the perfect bride. This miraculous sign reveals his glory. It reveals his glory. Some quick personal lessons that we can take from this. Right. This teaches us that you can go to him with little things. Right. We can go to Jesus with little things. This was really a little thing in the scope of everything, in the scope of these people's rest of their lives. This was small. A lot of the commentators and stuff say, you know, this wasn't a big deal, right? They were in a, you know, here's God just taking care of a social issue. But Jesus and his omnipotence takes the time to fix that socially embarrassing, awkward moment in the lives of this family. There's nothing too small for God's detailed care. The other thing is to submit to his timing. When Mary comes with a normal request, a perfectly legitimate request, and he looks at her and says it's not time. All right. And then he tells the servants to do something that looks totally counterproductive. They're not bringing wine jars to him. They're bringing ceremonial water jars to him. It's a picture of what a lot of our Christian life looks like, doing something counter what we would think would be counterproductive, but God's working it. If you don't have the perfect marriage, or maybe you're not married yet and you're thinking, will I ever get married? I want the perfect wedding, I want the perfect marriage. That's not gonna be on this side. You know, as good as my marriage is, it's not perfect. But he's offering us a perfect marriage, a perfect wedding, a perfect wedding feast. That's what we have to look forward to. All right. And there's more, but I'm not going to go through it all. All right. As we get ready to stand up and sing.
Close out here.
Can you hear me? All right. So how do we receive all this? How do we receive all this? We have to do two things. We have to admit that we're empty. We have to come to the idea that we're empty. They didn't bring full jars to him. They brought empty jars. They had to admit that they had run out of wine. All right, Jesus wasn't just topping them off. He wasn't just an extra little thing to them. He was everything. He brought everything to the table. We have to admit that we are empty, that we're all out. We have to take, the other thing that we have to do is take all the credit. That seems kind of weird. You know, taking credit for somebody else's work, but that's what we have to do. When Jesus did this miracle, they filled the jars with water, and then he said, dip some out and take it to the master of the ceremonies. And then the master of ceremony goes, whoa, this is the best thing ever. And he goes to the bridegroom. He didn't go to Jesus. The bridegroom got all the credit, and that's what we have to do. We have to understand that to become a Christian, to go to the Lord, is to accept, is to say, you know what? Jesus died for me, and now I am clothed in his righteousness. I'm clothed in his goodness and all the things that he did, that's now me. I have to take the credit for him, for what he did for me. That's how God sees us. Jesus sat in the midst of all that joy, sipping the cup of sorrow that was to come, so that you and I can sit in the midst of all this sorrow, sipping the cup of joy that is to come. All right, and as we stand to sing, we offer this opportunity to you. In all this sorrow, we're more than willing to pray with things that you're going through. If you haven't accepted Christ, we would love to give you that opportunity this morning to understand that cup of joy and where it comes from. As much as we'd love to explain it, as many words as I could use, it would never, ever be enough. You have to experience it for yourself. Let's all stand and let's sing.